Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the Professor again. Here we are talking once again about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had a pre-dawn raid about it a few weeks ago, and you liked it so much. I was inundated by an email asking for another, longer, deeper version of the show. I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Heather from NPR. Heather's brand new to the show, but we got a reminder that we have stalking problems, so we don't use last names.
Oh, okay.
We do use last names, however, when we have another professor, a real professor in the room. And that, of course, is Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, who's here on my right. Hello,
Professor. Nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Professor Nash is an expert on the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's an expert on 20th century international relations and diplomatic history, and he's working now on a book on
early American female ambassadors.
Early American female ambassadors, which has there's got to be some great myths busted in there about them, about us not having any. First of all,
right? Well, exactly. There are probably no myths because people don't know much about them to begin with.
No, we're supposed to make up the myths. Concoct these myths in order to keep it going.
I'll work on that.
Well, I guess the myth would be that we didn't have
it. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And by the way, by early, I mean mid-20th century. I don't mean early American history. Let me make that clear.
Well, the millennials probably think you mean early 21st century, the ambassadors of 25 or something.
Exactly.
Aunt Ginger is also, of course, listening in, as she always is, from a remote location, an undisclosed location. But we're here in the Buzzkill Bunker because we want to talk again, as I said, in more depth about the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a very important thing. Tomorrow is going to be the anniversary of, I think, of the discovery of the missiles, right?
Right, right. Correct. Yes. The October 14th is when the U.S. discovered the presence of the Soviet missiles.
Through those U-2 flights?
Correct. U-2 overflights. Yep.
Okay. So it's a very it's not the 50th anniversary, it's not the 60th anniversary, but still an annual anniversary, and we want to talk more about it because we opened the door the other day and we wanted to go in further. Professor Nash, can you tell us more about the basic outline of the early stages of the Cuban Missile Crisis? I was watching a thing on YouTube the other day, and it was a Kennedy clip about a news conference, a sort of small news conference, and the level of detail they went in about the missile crisis in 1963. Was amazing. So it was obviously a very big deal that people thought about for a very long time, but lots of people seem to just not think about it anymore or brush it off as, oh, bang, bang, it happened, it was over.
Right. Well, no, I mean, I think it's important because it's the closest we came to World War III. I think every historian agrees about that. But but it basically has two origins. One is in the Cold War. Obviously, you had this ongoing confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Right.
We can talk later if you want about why Khrushchev did this, but he's basically trying to break out of the encirclement of U.S.-led alliances in Eurasia that have hemmed in the Soviet Union. Right? There's a struggle for global power.
Okay, and can I ask you there? There's a sort of ring around the Soviet Union, the
right.
Western Soviet Union,
yes.
with U.S. missiles in European
right,
countries, or,
right,
or
yes.
armies anyway.
Armies, navies, everything. But you know, NATO and other alliances were basically trying to contain the Soviet Union. That
right.
was the basic U.S. policy. And that included NATO missiles in places like Italy and Turkey. Famously, uh-huh. we'll talk about those later. And that's one of Khrushchev's motivations behind this deployment is he wants, as he said in his memoir, he wanted to give the United States a little of its own medicine.
Ooh.
So, in other words, he was actually really bugged by having our missiles close to his borders, so he wanted to get a little payback. But also, more broadly, he's trying to break out of this encirclement, and Cuba presents an opportunity. And that's the other main context, which often gets overlooked. This is not just a U.S.-Soviet crisis. This is a triangular crisis. Cuba had been trying to get out from under U.S. domination for decades.
Right.
Maybe some of your listeners have seen Godfather Part II.
Yes.
They get a very good sense of what Cuba was like in the 1950s. It was essentially an X-rated Disneyland for American tourists, including Senator John F. Kennedy at one point, by the way.
I loved it there.
So, you know, you have this sort of anti-American revolution in 1959 led by Fidel Castro.
Right.
And so then he is immediately pressured very, very hard by the United States. There's an economic blockade.
Mm.
There are plots to assassinate Fidel Castro. We can talk about those if you want. The United States severs diplomatic relations. And so, and then
the famous Bay of Pigs.
Exactly. Bay of Pigs invasion, 1961. So the,
can you explain a little bit about Bay of Pigs and what exactly?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, because that's a precursor to what's going
on. Absolutely. Yeah. It's huge, huge link. Basically, Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, who was Kennedy's predecessor, in 1960, okays a CIA project to overthrow Castro's government. And the way he would do it is the CIA would arm and train a group of anti-Castro Cuban exiles in Central America and then return them to Cuba. They invaded at the Bay of Pigs. It was a notorious disaster. Most of the raiders were either captured or killed. And it was a humiliation for John F. Kennedy. And on the Soviet side, by this point, the Soviet Union is backing Fidel Castro. And now, obviously, the Cuban Revolution seems really threatened by the United States.
Mm-hmm. So this was an Eisenhower-era plan, but it happens by the time Kennedy's
correct.
In office.
Kennedy inherits it, but he gives the approval. And, and later on, he regretted it, obviously. But he approved it, and partly because in the 1960 campaign, he had run on a platform of sort of get tough on Cuba.
Right.
And that the Eisenhower administration had dropped the ball by allowing this communist revolution in our backyard.
Yeah.
So he feels it's sort of self-imposed pressure for him to do something. So he okays the project. It blows up in his face. And then after that, he just continues to obsess about Cuba. I don't think that's an overstatement.
Right.
Plots to assassinate Castro continue. Some of them are retrospectively hilarious.
You mean the exploding cigar?
The exploding cigar.
This
yes.
I used to see that in cartoons.
Exactly. It's like Spy versus Spy.
I guess it was just before Kennedy that Michael Corleone was trying to get out of Cuba. Did Eisenhower extract him? Are we going to find some documentation, something that the Eisenhower government went in and got
I will continue to look for that.
That could be a third book.
Exactly. I'm looking for another project. But in any case, Kennedy basically doubles down on his pressure on Cuba. They have a whole bunch of very large-scale military maneuvers in the Caribbean. You would sort of U.S. practicing its amphibious invasion. One of them was against a mythical leader by the name of Ortsak, which if you spell it backwards is kind of suggestive.
Oh, wait a minute. Heather, you do the math. Ortsak backwards.
Ortsak.
Let me spell this.
Right. What could it possibly be?
Yeah, pretty subtle, right?
Yeah.
In any case,
tell the killers out there, they need to know.
Castro.
They're in their cars. They're babysitting their kids.
Yeah, they invaded the island of Vieques, which was sort of a military training area for the U.S. In any case, so their plots to assassinate Castro, economic blockade, lots of pressure. So from the standpoint of the Kremlin, you've got this new ally outside of this containment zone, right? You should think geographically. The Soviets see an opportunity to sort of have an ally on America's doorstep, right? It's only 90 miles to Key West. And so they start sort of building up Soviet military forces in Cuba to defend the Cuban Revolution. Right. And that's something that is often overlooked on the American side, the extent to which, JFK and others helped cause the Cuban Missile Crisis by threatening Cuba. That often gets overlooked. And then Khrushchev does the ultimate mistake, which is to include in this buildup nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States. That's what he decides to do in the spring of 1962, secretly.
Okay. Did Castro want these things?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely,
that's interesting.
Yes.
Because in a way, you can understand how a Latin American, a Caribbean leader would, despite not wanting to be pushed around by the United States, doesn't want yet another European colonial domination.
Right. Well, and that's actually an important way of looking at it, because Cuba was dependent for sugar sales on the United States, and now it was dependent for sugar sales on the Soviet Union. So it really did sort of trade one sort of big brother for another. But he definitely wants these most modern missiles. Partly to defend his revolution, but also partly, as he said, to sort of strengthen the socialist camp, quote unquote, worldwide.
Oh.
So, I mean, Castro also understands himself as part of a larger international movement and struggle against the forces of imperialism, as they would have put it. So, yeah. So, in other words, both the Soviets and the Cubans had legitimate reason to fear an American invasion. In other words, that you might, after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, the United States might decide, well, that didn't work, so next time we'll do a real invasion with U.S. troops on a much larger scale to make sure it works this time.
Yeah.
Right? And from the Soviet and Cuban standpoint, that's a legitimate fear.
Right.
There's no question about that.
Hmm.
But Khrushchev makes the horrible decision in the spring of 1962 to deploy intermediate and medium range ballistic missiles to Cuba secretly. And these are weapons that had enormous nuclear warheads, far, far larger than the Hiroshima weapons.
Oh, no kidding.
That could have reached most of the United States in very little time.
Well, would there then have been a Cuban Missile Crisis if they had been just regular missiles, not nuclear warheads?
That's a very good question. Probably not, because the United States knew that there was a conventional Soviet military buildup in the summer of 1962. They knew it.
Yeah.
And the Kennedy assumed it would remain conventional. And so that's why he...
Conventional killers meaning non-nuclear.
Right, non-nuclear. So tanks, aircraft, infantry, etc. Surface-to-air missiles that are only defensive, only good for shooting down airplanes. And in September of 62, Kennedy publicly warns the Soviets, don't deploy any nuclear missiles, right? This has got to be conventional only. And at that point, the deployment was already underway. And, you know, someone like Ted Sorensen, who was a Kennedy speechwriter, he said many years later, you know, had we known they were going to put in nuclear weapons, we would have said, we will tolerate no more than 100 nuclear weapons in Cuba, which is a really interesting, in other words, and that a lot of people point to that quote and others and say, look, so maybe this wasn't such a big deal. The big deal was the deception, the lying, and that sort of thing. And then it becomes more about prestige and politics and less about the strategic balance.
So it's not really that proposal, that earlier proposal would have been a crayon line in the sand.
Exactly, a crayon line. Or maybe a dry eraser marker.
Something that could be a little
more exactly. Right, a little more flexible. But yeah, that's one of the great things that historians always argue about is, was this really a military threat to the United States? Or was this about politics and prestige and face and things like that? Yeah. Because during the crisis itself, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, he actually said, I don't think this Soviet deployment really changes the military balance very much. Huh. Now, the generals, of course, thought it did. But they would have thought, you know, a single Soviet biplane in Cuba would have upset the balance of military power. But he said, but no, this is not significant militarily.
That's kind of... getting in with a question that I have in my head, just listening to you talking about this, it's like, why would a tiny little country like Cuba want to be standing up to the United States pretty much by themselves? Yeah, there's the Soviet Union, but they're a long ways away.
Right. But also, you know, they feel exposed because they're the unique country in the Western Hemisphere. The rest of the Western Hemisphere is entirely U.S. allies, countries in Central and South America dominated by the United States. So Cuba's the outlier. So it immediately – once – you know, and it's sort of a tit for tat. The two sides build up – you know, the United States becomes hostile to Cuba. Cuba feels like it needs an external ally. It reaches out to the Soviet Union, makes it appear more threatening to the United States. And so there's this sort of mutual hostility that just grows and grows and grows, feeding on itself.
Mm-hmm. And also the Soviet Union probably feels, well, we're ringed by American allies. And we've got, you know, you've got Germany, France. Well, maybe Germany's not nuclear power, but France, England, blah, blah, blah. And those secret missiles in Turkey, and we have nothing in. We're not parking missiles in Toronto. You know, we don't have a Canadian ally. We don't have a Mexican ally. So you know, damn it, we need something to balance the power.
And that's also one of the great what ifs. What if Khrushchev announces publicly, "Hey, I'm doing what you're doing in Cuba, in Turkey. I'm putting missiles in," and that would put the United States in a real box because it was true. Then the Soviets would be doing nothing that the United States hadn't already done. And it makes it very difficult for the United States sort of politically to take that stance.
Now, we'll get to these Turkish missiles in a little while, Buzzkillers, because that whole thing is absolutely fascinating. It's one of Professor Nash's specialties. So can you tell us then – so right now we know sort of what's happened, right? Well, the buildup, if you will. So then what happens to make it the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Right. So the American intelligence, have U-2 overflights over Cuba, and they'd been actually stopped for a few weeks, which was part of the problem. So they resume on October 14th. By that point, they've resumed these flights, and they discover the presence of the missiles.
Right.
So that news is brought to Kennedy, and Kennedy immediately forms his group of advisors. It comes to be called the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, or XCOM for short. This is this famous sort of group that meets every day of the crisis, sometimes several times a day, to discuss what to do. They immediately come to consensus that we can't tolerate these missiles. They have to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, that's still an open question whether that's actually a legitimate consensus. In any case, they there's no disagreement about that. The question becomes how. How do you get them out? And immediately there are some people who say in the XCOM, we need an airstrike. The only way to remove these is militarily. Have an airstrike that takes them out. The military is big in favor of that. A lot of people on the XCOM, so to civilians, are in favor of that. Then there are other people who start pushing for the blockade. In other words, you set up a blockade that prevents further, because the Soviet buildup with these missiles is ongoing.
Right.
By ship. Mm-hmm. And so then the idea is you have a blockade. You use the fact that the United States has overwhelming conventional superiority in the Caribbean, which it did. One of the reasons this is a stupid decision by the Soviets, by the way. You set up a blockade. Then the further Soviet shipments can't reach Cuba. And it's also useful as a way of signaling. You signal the Soviet Union, we're serious about this. We want to do something about this. But it's not as radical a step as an airstrike. The airstrike, by the way, is still an option.
Right.
Right. You go to the blockade and you still have that. You still have that military club in your hand. The
pilots are still waiting to go.
Right.
Now, as I understand it, from way back in my undergraduate days, a blockade is technically an act of war.
Yes, it is. Which is
so
why.
How did they get away with that?
Yeah. Well, they finesse it linguistically. If Kennedy referred to it as a quarantine. Which is hilarious, right? Because it's sort of like then it gets this whole sort of
quarantine zone.
It's like a disease, right? We have to stop this Soviet disease from spreading. But yeah, and that's because his legal advisor was telling him you can't use the B word because that's an act. That's it, right. All the legal people in the State Department are going, no, that's you can't say it's a blockade. And so they call it a quarantine, even though it is a blockade, and you have no right to stop ships on the high seas and point a gun at them and say we're going to search your ship. Right. You can't do that. But the United States did it anyway, and they got away with it, partly because they're overwhelmingly superior in that area. Yeah, so they start the blockade, and it becomes a crisis on October 22nd when Kennedy goes on national television. You can watch this on YouTube.
We'll try to put a link on the website, Buzzkill.
He goes on national television and announces the presence of these Soviet missiles and announces the blockade. Mm-hmm. In the Kennedy administration, generally, there was what I would call the cult of options. Kennedy loved keeping his options open, even more so than most leaders. And I think that's something that attracted him about the blockade, is that you're putting the Soviets on notice. They can't ship anything further. And then you see what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he liked that option. But he had also been told, by the way, that an airstrike could not guarantee 100% success. And that's the thing about nuclear weapons. Political scientists talk about minimum deterrence. In other words, if one Soviet nuclear weapon hits an American city, a couple million people die. And Kennedy was more sensitive to that than some of his advisors, by the way. So you attack these missiles in Cuba. All it takes is one to survive. And the Air Force said, we can promise you a 90% destruction rate.
Now, you just said...
Not very good.
I think you just said that one of his advisors, sort of was willing to accept the loss of one American city or one launch or something, or was willing to...
I think they... I'll put it this way. Some of them were cavalier about the risks.
Eek.
Yeah. Cavalier about
the risks. How far north could these things actually go?
The longer range ones could cover most of the lower 48 states. So there was one missile that was 2,200 mile range. And if you look at the maps, and you can find these online too, there were the radius of the missiles covers most of the lower 48.
Including New York and Washington.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The shorter range ones, I think, are like 15 or 1,100 miles, I forget, but covers easily the southeast of the country and all the major cities, including Washington and New York.
If it had hit Toledo, I wouldn't have been born. I was born in Toledo a year after this started.
There are a million what-ifs.
Actually, it was more 6 months after. But anyway.
And once again, you know, everyone, I think, has a sense of how big the Hiroshima bomb was. That was about 15 kilotons. Of TNT equivalent. These missiles and aerial bombs in this era are bigger by a factor of 100 or 200.
Crikey.
So enormously, enormously destructive. If a single one gets through, it wipes out an entire city.
Okay, so let me see if I can get this set up for the buzzkillers out there. You've got the United States has this quarantine around Cuba. Presumably that means nothing's going out either.
Correct.
And these Soviet ships are steaming are still steaming towards Cuba. What happens when they get to the line? Do they get to the line? What happens?
Right. Well, there is this. This is the one of the major myths I think we need to blow up here.
Yes, okay. Myth time.
Yes, time
our
to
whole
bust.
Reason for being.
Because I mean, I think in the popular consciousness, this, and you actually saw in some political cartoons at the time, that this was seen as sort of like an Old West showdown.
Oh, cool. Sort at of, high noon.
We're at high noon. And there's, and there's, and there's even a book called Eyeball to Eyeball. There's this famous quote from Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State. And we were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other guy just blinked. And that refers to this alleged moment when a Soviet ship with full of military cargo came up to the blockade line and at the last minute turned around, and thank goodness, because World War III was avoided. Mm-hmm. That, we've learned recently, is a myth. Mm-hmm. No ship got closer than about 750 miles and before Khrushchev turned it around.
750
yes.
miles?
So unless, you, unless your just definition a... of the OK Corral is rather expansive, that was not a real showdown.
Was that just outside Lisbon or something? Is that very
exactly. Did it even leave the Black Sea? Yeah, yeah. And so yeah, remove some of the drama from that particular aspect.
You know, it makes me wonder if somebody was trying to be poetic and nod toward the revolution without waiting until you see the whites in their eyes
right.
or something
right.
like that.
Yeah, and you know, and it's an important point more broadly. After the missile crisis, there's everyone sort of as we'd say today, cashes in on it, right? There's all this sort of literature that plays up this moment. And the historiography for many, many years, this was a confrontation where Kennedy sort of stared down Khrushchev and won, quote unquote. And that it's cut and dried, and thank goodness he was such a tough guy. And we'll get into this in a bit, but that picture has been transformed in the in our understanding.
As you know, Buzzkillers, the historiography means the interpretations right. of the
right.
history at the time. And then of course, it evolves. So the ship, there isn't this ship called the Kimarov or Kimoskov or something that gets too close to the line and is I was told in school that the U.S. Navy actually fired a shot across its bow, and it said
no.
"Oh," and beat it home.
No, now as we'll get into this in a minute. They were doing some other risky things, like using practice depth charges against Soviet submarines. But that's not exactly a shot across the bow. Yeah, there was no shooting. There was discussion in the Pentagon. And this is something that the Secretary of Defense was alarmed by. You know, he was sort of grilling the Navy. How do you run a blockade? What if a Soviet ship or other ship decides not to stop? What do you do? Mm. And the Navy said, well, then we'll shoot at its rudder.
Oh, rudder. Oh, okay.
You know, so that it can't steer or whatever, or make it so it's dead in the water. And McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, was rightly alarmed at that. And, you know, the Navy's attitude was, you know, as one admiral said, we've been, Mr. Secretary, we've been running blockades since the time of John Paul Jones. Basically, would you let us do our jobs, please?
Yeah.
And the Secretary of Defense is basically, the stakes are way too high to allow you and your standard operating procedures to be in place here. And so they were trying to micromanage and for good reason. But it never actually came to that. They never actually fired at a rudder or fired a shot across the bow.
Okay.
And how could you if it was 750 miles
that's
away?
That's a long shot.
That's a long shot across the bow.
Well, maybe the Navy didn't even fire shots across the bow by that time. Maybe that was
right.
That was John Paul Jones.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little old school by that point.
But firing at a rudder, destroying a rudder, that I can imagine the other Soviet ships would have reacted.
Right. I mean, the good news is there aren't a lot of Soviet, in fact, I don't think there are any Soviet surface ships in the area during the missile crisis. It's all cargo ships.
No kidding.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of any surface ships. There are, like I said, there are plenty of Soviet attack submarines in the area.
Okay. The myths are all falling from my eyes.
Yep,
Buster.
Sorry. Sorry. Well, I think I'm actually losing weight
in this show.
And that's partly because the Soviets knew what they were up against. Hmm. And another thing I was going to say is the fact that Khrushchev turns the ship around so far short of the blockade is part of a larger point, which is all the evidence these days on both sides, in terms of Kennedy and Khrushchev, shows their caution. That's sort of the good news. We'll talk about the bad news later. The good news is that the two people in charge, where sort of the chips are down, they are both very aware of how this might spin out of control. And so they bend over backwards to be far more cautious than a lot of their advisors are.
That's interesting because I'd always been told, again, Buzzkillers, this was my elementary high school, that Khrushchev was the hothead and Kennedy was the calm one. And that's why the world survived because of the wonderful Kennedy.
Right. I think if anything, what you see is sort of a learning curve on both sides. Yes, Khrushchev was impulsive. That's true about him. The decision to send those missiles in secretly and to think you could get away with it, that was really rash, really impulsive. They didn't staff that out very well, to put it mildly. But once it's a public confrontation and you start to think about how this could spin out of control, both leaders are very, very cautious. This is true of JFK too. If you look at the, we have all the tapes, all the transcripts from the XCOM meetings, the key days, October 27th. Mm-hmm. Kennedy is leading the charge for a peaceful resolution. And he's actually getting into it with some of his advisors who are a little riskier, a little more intent on quote unquote winning, even at the risk of war. Whereas Kennedy is pulling out all the stops to make sure that there's a peaceful resolution if possible.
Without saving face. Or
right,
face.
Right, exactly. Right. And, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. He's trying to walk a middle line there, and that explains the secret deal for the Jupiter missiles.
Okay, so then the eyeball-to-eyeball thing never actually happened.
Nope.
So that means Kennedy, Khrushchev, they're not quite as much of schoolyard...
bullies.
Yeah, I'd say schoolyard bullies, schoolyard right. Adversaries,
right.
As you might think. And it's more about making concessions and making sure that
right.
that nobody's losing face.
Right.
But
losing face, that's a good that's
right.
A good
and that's why, I don't know if we want to talk about the end of the crisis yet, but that's one of the reasons why you have this sort of complicated conclusion of the crisis.
Well, we had a show on Yogi Berra the other day, so we're not going to talk about the end to the end. It won't be over till it's over.
Oh, Yogi.
Listen, Buzzkillers, we have to take a little break here because we wouldn't even gotten this far in this show without our wonderful Kickstarter supporters, without our wonderful supporters in general. I need to have a big shout out to John Racine, Kevin Primus, and Jake Orsic, who not only funded us tremendously generously through Kickstarter, but have been following the show, promoting it with their friends. And of course, Aunt Ginger is out there in the intersphere monitoring us. She's actually having she's having lunch right now with her doppelganger, Jill St. John. And they're trying to figure out some sort of agreement where Aunt Ginger can sit in on can stand in on for Jill in one of her new movies.
Jill St. John?
My Aunt Ginger looks like Jill St. John. I know.
Oh, you know. Well, I have to Google that later.
it's a famous buzzkill trait. We all look like movie stars in one way or another. So, and Ginger Buzzkill and Jill St. John are the same, basically the same. She gets stopped on the street all the time.
Yeah, so I'm getting a Matt Damon vibe off of you.
Are you really?
Oh, yeah.
With my Boston accent and my 25-year-old physique.
There you go.
So thanks, everyone. Thanks. And of course, thanks so much to Epicast. Folks, we haven't been advertising Epicast shows lately. We need to start doing that again because they're just wonderful. They work all the hours that the deity or whoever sends. So we wouldn't get anywhere without them. They do all the editing. They do absolutely everything, and they tell me what to do. If they didn't tell me what to do, we would be lost. But let's get back to the crisis. So we've busted at least one myth, right? The eyeball-to-eyeball myth. We busted the kind of OK Corral myth that the ships are steaming.
Right.
The, you know, the confrontation has a 750-mile right. buffer zone right. between right. it. But there are also other myths going on. A lot of them spread by the administration after the fact. And one of the things that the Buzzkillers would be so interested in hearing is something called the trollop ploy, because I know all of you out there are fantastic fans of the Victorian novelist Anthony Trollope, who wrote these huge triple-decker novels that were about 3,000 pages long and right. convoluted and tedious beyond belief. But anyway, there is a thing called the trollop ploy, and it's all part of this negotiation, allegedly, but it's also part of the myth. So what's that all about, Professori? Right.
Okay, so for the idea, I don't know which novel. I've never read Anthony Trollope.
They all have the trollop ploy in them.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I didn't even know that. Well, okay, we'll explain it, learning it, something.
Yeah.
But basically, it's where in the books, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the young woman interprets a handshake as a proposal for marriage.
Yes, kind of.
Okay, right. So in other words, she's... It's a very, very, very creative interpretation of an offer. Anyway, the end of that week, October 20th.
Well, let me say, I wrote it out kind of legalistically because I had to make sure I knew what it was. And it was a plot device whereby, you know, people got in a misunderstanding about a 10-pound note or some sort of silly thing, and then two people suddenly end up married. You know, it's one of these bizarre Victorian coincidences. Okay. So I wrote this down. Now listen to this, Killers. How legalistic and convoluted is this? A trollop ploy is a situation where person A purposely misinterprets person B's proposal, usually in a matter of degree, emphasis, tone, things like that, so that it becomes acceptable. That is, person B's proposal becomes acceptable to person A, even though they took it a different way. Person A then responds to person B, are you still with me, as if the changed proposal is what person B meant all along. Okay, get me, Buzzkillers? This is what the Kennedy administration thought they were doing.
Welcome to Victorian literature.
We will never mention trollop again on this show as long as I live. Which may not be very long.
Is that where the term trollop, oh, she's such a trollop, comes
from?
No,
actually, that's not only spelled differently, it's different etymology.
Okay.
The poor bastard's name was trollop.
Okay.
T-R-O-L-L-O-P-E.
I'm thinking, is that somebody who's manipulative?
No.
Okay. Strike that.
Actually, I should look that up. I could have that wrong, but I'm pretty sure that they don't relate.
All
right.
Yep. Strike it from the record.
Must have been a terrible name to have for Anthony Trollope's wife.
Oh.
They call her TT, right?
Anywho.
Right. So how is that relevant? So at the end of the week, right, this crisis is built.
Remind us what week we were in.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the week of October 22nd, which I believe was a Monday. That's when Kennedy announces the crisis. And so
to the public,
and he sets up the blockade within a couple of days. There's this famous confrontation at the UN where our ambassador Adlai Stevenson says that he's willing to wait until hell freezes over, when he basically beats up on this sad old man who's the Soviet ambassador to the UN
to get an answer from
the right there, exactly to get, right and where they sort of reveal the photographs to the world, etc. And a couple of days later on the 26th, so now we're getting to the end of the week. Pressure has built on Khrushchev to do something. And so he publicly offers, he issues this long rambling statement. And in it, he basically publicly proposes that if Kennedy agreed not to invade Cuba, he would pull his missiles out. Then the next morning, Khrushchev sends a private letter. So this is private, this is in secret, to Kennedy saying, we want you to remove your missiles from Turkey as well. And then we'll remove our missiles. So in the history of the crisis for many, many years, the sort of masterstroke on the U.S. side was, and it was a debate about who came up with the so-called trollop ploy, was to ignore the second suggestion and embrace
the
first.
Which is to get rid of the missiles in Cuba, in Turkey.
In Turkey, right. In other words, you pick the one that you find more acceptable and pretend like the other one didn't exist.
Well, helped by the fact that there were two.
There were two, and helped by the fact that only one was public.
Okay.
Right? The more acceptable one was public. So the idea was, then they respond to Khrushchev and say, basically, we like your suggestion of the 26th. Right?
Right.
So, and that was the basic story for many, many years, even in my book, unfortunately. I'm sad to say, you get the idea that that's essentially how it went down.
Right.
Now it's pretty clear. And, you know, if I'd sort of thought about this a little harder, I guess, in my own book. It's quite clear that the Kennedys secretly embraced the second proposal as well. And there's this famous meeting, it's now famous, we have all the notes from it, where his Kennedy's brother, Robert F. Kennedy, the attorney general,
that guy's
trusted confidant, meets with the Soviet ambassador and basically says, look, we will agree not to invade Cuba. We will pull the Turkish missiles out. After a decent interval, he didn't use that term, but that's basically, in other words, to make it look like it wasn't a quid pro quo, but basically relax, those missiles will be gone. But that has to remain secret. And he's quite clear about that. He says, if you go try and go public with this, the deal's off.
Public with the missile part.
With the missile part, correct.
The Turkish missile
part. The Turkish missile part, right.
God, there's so many missiles in this damn story.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important. It's secret, so it denies Khrushchev the benefit of that, right? If Khrushchev could have said, hey, look what I got out of this. I got to remove these missiles from Turkey. But he's not allowed to do that. But at the end of the day, he does get something in addition to a no invasion pledge. But the no invasion pledge, that was public. the Turkish Jupiter swap, that was secret and remained secret for many, many years.
Until you and a couple of other people broke it.
When did it come out? What really happened? Or how?
Well, yeah, I mean, for a long, long, if you look at like Robert F. Kennedy's campaign book, which is what it was, it's called 13 Days, came out in 1968, 1969, because he was running for president in 1968.
Is that why it came out?
And in it, you know, it's not a bad book, and it contains a lot of good stuff in it, but it's essentially a campaign document where he's trying to sort of pump up his role, his foreign policy cred.
Yeah.
And by the way, the explicit nature of the Turkish missile trade, that was cut out by the guy reworking that book, and that's Ted Sorensen. Mm-hmm. Ted Sorensen was Kennedy's speechwriter, very close to the Kennedys, and basically later on, 1989, he admitted, yeah, I cut that part out of of the 13 Days book.
Okay.
But so there were people who guessed right away that there was a quid pro quo. They weren't taken very seriously. Later on, really in the 80s, 1980s, you start to see some of the declassified documents. You start to see the first of the transcripts. Richard Nixon was not the only president to record meetings in the White House.
Yes, I've seen some of those.
He's actually in pretty good company. So we start to get tape transcripts. We start to get declassified minutes of meetings. And we get RFK's memoranda of the meetings with Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador. And then it slowly becomes clear. It was certainly clear by the time I was writing my book in the 1990s that this was a quid pro quo. It was secret. It was sequential. Right? They removed their missiles immediately. We would remove our missiles a few months down the road. But nevertheless,
hopefully everyone had forgotten about it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then the public understanding at the time was, as we were saying earlier, this was a showdown, and the other guy blinked. Mm-hmm. The Kennedy administration afterwards said, we didn't really give anything up because we weren't planning to invade Cuba anyway. That's questionable at best. It's quite conceivable they could have invaded Cuba sort of with the conventional invasion once the missiles were gone. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it seemed like Kennedy got the better of the deal because all we did was make a no invasion pledge, whereas we removed this deadly threat to us.
Right.
You know, and Khrushchev didn't get that much, right? He wanted missiles to be in place in Cuba, and then once they're in place, he would announce it to the world and basically say, there's nothing you can do about it, and now we're much stronger. So, he did lose in that sense. The missiles in Turkey were obsolete. They were of dubious military value.
Oh, no kidding.
But they did bug Khrushchev, and then they were gone.
Okay.
Only months after they'd become operational, so.
Can I ask you something about this thing about, like, documents being classified for a certain period of time, and historians are not able to find out, to bust myths really until later, because of course I never knew all about this, and you know, I get stopped in the street all the time, people begging me, how do you find out about this stuff? I grew up knowing X, and now you're telling me this, and you know, I can't walk through an airport anymore without hordes of people asking me about classified documents gag orders and things like that, you know, just apart from the autograph seekers. So what kind of happens in American history in terms of documents and archives and stuff like that? Are they closed for a number of years and then open?
It's a really good question. We do not have a firm 30-year rule like they have in place like Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing struggle. Historians constantly have to harass the government, and especially for the sensitive stuff, especially for intelligence related stuff. The CIA is notorious among historians for not being very cooperative.
Even if stuff is older than 30 years?
Oh, yeah.
There is no rule.
Well, the CIA doesn't want to release some stuff from World War II.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They have one of the worst attitudes. Essentially, these documents are ours. You have no right to look at them. Whereas historians argue these belong to everybody. Why don't you hand them over?
Yeah.
So especially if it involves nuclear weapons or intelligence or really sensitive stuff, sometimes it stays classified for a long, long time. The State Department, they've got this official Foreign Relations of the United States series. It's sort of the official record. Mm-hmm. They're basically playing catch up. I mean, in fairness, they're understaffed. They've got to deal with all these other agencies to get stuff cleared.
Right.
But right now, they're basically in the mid late 1970s.
Oh, no kidding.
Releasing stuff. And you know, what I worry is about is historians of this period right now, where a lot of it's electronic and a lot of it's email and a lot of it gets destroyed. I mean, I love working in my period, mid 20th century. Mm-hmm. It's all on paper and it's all typed.
Yeah, right.
I don't have to worry about reading anyone's handwriting. Right? I would never touch the 19th century. Yeah, no. Well. But so, yeah, in the future, it's going to be a problem. But for this period, it's all on paper. And now for the early 60s, most of it's released. By the way, it's often heavily redacted, as they say. It's got the little black boxes where they still black out certain stuff. Okay.
And is there a way for them to I think of things being redacted or someone like the CIA being able to block historians mm-hmm. if there's a connection to something right now that's a national history issue or a national security issue.
The problem is their definition of what constitutes related to something now is extremely broad. The CIA, their buzz phrase is sources and methods. In other words, anything that might reveal our sources of intelligence or how we collect intelligence, we can't release to you. Mm-hmm. It's a real stretch. I can't imagine that they're still using sources and methods from World War II.
Right.
I think those sources are all dead.
They're all dead, and I sure hope their methods have changed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Otherwise,
Morse code.
Right. And so there's this constant struggle. But one of the nice things, one of the sort of games historians play is when you go to different libraries, like presidential libraries or the National Archives, or if you go to enough different places, sometimes you can find different versions of the same document that have been redacted differently.
Oh. Ooh.
And I've actually
that's like
somewhere
a puzzle that can
somewhere
undo.
In my papers, yeah. I actually have a top secret memo, and it's got 4 points in the memo. And one version has 1 and 3 blocked out, and the other has 2 and 4 blocked out.
Are you sure you want to let this go out?
Yeah, sorry.
You go let this go out in the public. They right. make you knock on their door tomorrow morning.
It happens all the time. Or you're looking at the version in the Foreign Relations of the United States series, but I got another version of the document, and one is heavily redacted, and the one I got that was routinely declassified, in other words, part of a bulk declassification. Mm-hmm. It was released in full, and it just makes us shake our heads because it's such a crapshoot.
Do you then, and once you've made use of them and got the sort of interpretations you need out of them in publication, mm-hmm. do you then share them with your buddies?
Sure, if you're in touch with other historians, we share documents all the time. Absolutely.
Guess what? You won't believe what they
let
through.
Yeah, check this out. Right. I was in the National Archives once and came across this very important report on NATO from early 1961, and the other guys who were researching there were absolutely blown away that I just stumbled across a copy that was completely unredacted and just once again routinely released. They had been looking for it for years, and I found it in a folder where none of them had thought to look. And that kind of thing happens all the time.
I hope you demanded some cash.
Yeah. I'm not handing this over for free. Are you kidding?
Yeah. Okay, so you've just explained the trollop ploy, and one of the phrases that you keep mentioning missiles, mm-hmm. Is Jupiter missiles.
Right.
What are
Jupiter missiles?
Tell me they don't reach Jupiter.
No, not even close. No, the range was about 1,500 miles. These are intermediate range ballistic missiles that the United States built. They also had sort of sister missiles, which were called Thor missiles, which were deployed in Britain.
Wow.
But basically, we had trouble putting together a workable intercontinental ballistic missile, and so these were a stopgap. So the way it worked out, they were almost instantly obsolete. These are nuclear missiles, can hit a target 1,500 miles away. So for them to reach the Soviet Union, we have to put them around the periphery of the Soviet Union. So in places like Britain, Italy, and Turkey.
Why would you even want to do that?
Yeah, well, and also they are super primitive. They're liquid fuel. They sit at fixed bases above ground. They're not in silos. Oh. So they basically they invite a first strike.
They're awesome.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah, they're horrible missiles.
Could they have hit Moscow and St. Petersburg?
Yes.
Or only like the southern cities like
No, Solomon. They could have hit Moscow.
Oh, okay.
They reached, and that's why they bugged Khrushchev so much. They could reach deep into the Soviet Union.
But the fallout, wouldn't it? Come over into your
that's a good point. Generally, if you'd had a nuclear exchange anytime after the mid-1950s, the entire northern hemisphere would have been completely enshrouded in deadly radiation. But there's this myth, and propagated partly by Robert F. Kennedy in 13 Days, but also you see it in Graham Allison's book, Essence of Decision, 1971, a whole bunch of other, because it's a good story. And the story was that Kennedy was chagrined at the end of the crisis when Khrushchev mentions the Turkish missiles, because Kennedy had ordered them to be dismantled before the crisis, and his orders were disobeyed.
Disobeyed,
yes. And partly this is – the Kennedys were big on sort of trashing the State Department.
Yeah.
Because the State Department was – they considered it this big, bloated, useless bureaucracy that was not reliable for anything. And here's a case in point, allegedly. It turns out it's a myth. I've looked at this very carefully. There's no evidence that, well, first of all, they were NATO missiles. Turkey owned the missiles. They weren't Kennedy's to order out. He could have removed the warheads because of this complex sharing arrangement.
Oh.
The host country gets the missile. The United States, under U.S. law, in accordance with U.S. law, keeps control of the warhead. In case of a crisis, you put the warhead on the missile. And then there's this dual key arrangement, where there's an American officer and a Turkish officer who turn their keys together to launch the missile. And that had some problems. They did an inspection tour of some Thor bases in Britain in 1959, and they found that there was a British officer who had both keys around his neck.
Nice. Oh, right, yeah, because he'd gone to Home Depot and
exactly, right, they hadn't had him copied. And, you know, they had his test launch, and at the last minute before the test launch, the second guy with the key didn't show up, so they just took a screwdriver in the keyhole and launched the missile.
Oh, so that keyhole was really secure.
Yeah, so we had some security issues. In any case, there's this myth that, you know, where Kennedy's like, wow, I ordered those things out, and there they are sitting there. And he was very chagrined by this.
You mean, but the American military said, no, we're not going to do it, or didn't do it? Or was it the Turkish military who didn't do it?
No, Kennedy never issued instructions to have these missiles removed from Turkey before the missile crisis. That's the myth.
Oh, the myth is that he was disobeyed. Oh, gotcha.
Yes.
Gotcha,
yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. Gotcha, the myth was that he was disobeyed, and that they're, and so then he thought they were gone, and then he's surprised to find out they're still there. That is a complete misconception. That is a complete myth. They explored in 61. They explored with the Turks, maybe having these removed. The Turks dug in their heels, and the Americans backed off.
Did the Turks feel that it was a security for themselves?
Yes. Yeah, actually, there's a real parallel between Turkey and Cuba in that regard. Mm. The Turks, a lot of other NATO allies, when these missiles were offered in 1957, had said, no, we don't want these. That'll make us sort of a nuclear lightning rod.
Yeah,
the Turks were much more militarist. They were happy to have, as they call them, the most modern weapons. Mm-hmm. So they were happy to host them. Italy was the only country that said yes, in addition to Great Britain, under a separate arrangement that was outside of NATO. But yeah, the Turkish would have looked at you funny if you had said, by the way, these are really primitive and they invite a first strike and they make no sense strategically. The Turks wouldn't have known what you were talking about. They saw these as modern weapons and they were happy to host them. And they resisted because they were just being deployed in 1961 and 62.
Right.
And in 61, the deployment's not finished. And the Americans are like, these are really obsolete. Could we pull those out? And the Turks are like, no. And Kennedy was fully aware that they were still there at the start of the crisis. This was not a surprise to him that they were there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talk about in my book is how in every day of the crisis, not only do they not avoid the issue, like some people later claimed, every day of the crisis, the Americans are talking about the Turkish missiles. They assumed that the Soviets were going to demand their removal. They worked on various plans. How can we, you know, give them up as part of a deal? And maybe Kennedy early in the crisis says, maybe we might have to give these up.
Yeah.
So it was on the table from the get-go.
Wow. So it's not a surprise. It's not as if the United States demands the Cuban missiles get removed and doesn't have to do anything in return.
Right.
All of that is a myth, the kind of, the blockade line, the line in the sand, the line in the sea it didn't really get used.
One of the important questions is, and this was also came out relatively recently, was not the Trollope ploy, but the Cordier ploy. Andrew Cordier was an official at the UN. On the last day of the crisis, October 27th, Dean Rusk, he really revealed this secret in 1990, that he was ordered by Kennedy to approach Andrew Cordier at the UN. And the idea was that if a public trade becomes necessary for the Turkish missiles, that Cordier would announce it publicly. In other words, Kennedy's making it so a third party says, hey, I got an idea. Why don't you both give up your missiles? And then Kennedy could say, hey, what a great idea. Hmm. We didn't want those missiles anyway. We don't know if Kennedy would have taken that step, but he put that step in place.
Wow.
As an additional option. No one knew about that besides Dean Rusk and Robert F. Kennedy and the president himself. The rest of the XCOM completely kept in the dark, and that's partly because a lot of them opposed a trade.
Yeah, yeah.
And that gets the whole question of the XCOM, because the XCOM has been played up as this great deliberative body.
Yeah, a real genius government
thing. A meeting of the minds, right, where we have it out and through argument arrive at the best decision. Most historians would question that as well. I don't know if that gets to the level of a myth.
Yeah.
But Right now, it looks like the XCOM was more about Kennedy using it as a way to build consensus, not a way to arrive at a decision. There's a big difference.
Okay.
Right? In other words, and on the 27th, they have these long conversations. He gets a lot of sort of pushback, and so then he just ignores them. And he radically shrinks the circle of people he's relying on. He's only relying on Dean Rusk and Robert F. Kennedy, maybe one or two other people. The hawks, the so-called hawks, the sort of the tougher people on the XCOM, he just cuts them out of it. So it
stops
not
inviting them.
He's making decisions outside of the XCOM and sending. For example, he sends Rusk to meet with Andrew Cordier at the UN, and the XCOM doesn't know about that.
And so of course, Kennedy has his own office; he can retreat to at any time.
Exactly, absolutely right. So the whole—if I can put it this way—the model of decision making in the missile crisis is a lot different than we once thought. A lot different.
Wow!
So, and to Kennedy's credit, Kennedy was the ultimate dove in a way, and he listened to his advisors and basically said, "You know what? I disagree, and I'm going to go off and do my own decision because I'm president." Right, sort of like that famous meeting where. The apocryphal story of Lincoln saying the eyes have it when he's the only one voting yes.
Yeah, because he's the president.
I get to outvote all of you. This is not a democracy.
So what's fascinating, one of the many things that's fascinating here is not only is this massive tension between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and possibly tensions of ships crossing blockade lines and shots fired over bows and all this sort of, but there's tension within this special committee.
Yes.
Committee Kennedy has set up to solve this crisis.
Yep.
So it's, you know, it's tension at home, tension abroad. And frankly, I'm like I said earlier, I'm losing weight in this show. It's positively nerve-wracking.
Right. Well, and also, if I can just interject here, this is the most recent evidence, lots of tension between Kennedy and his military.
Yes, that's
the Joint Chiefs of Staff, especially the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Curtis LeMay.
They're very hawky.
Extremely hawkish. Not only hawkish, they think they have to take orders from someone who's beneath them. They don't have any trust in his ability to lead the country. And you see it in meetings. They treat him with disdain.
Ugh.
And he sort of – you almost get the sense of him biting his tongue.
Wow.
Because there's one point where LeMay says – and this is on tape. LeMay says to Kennedy, well, you're in quite a fix, Mr. President. And Kennedy says, wait, what did you say? And LeMay says, you're in quite a fix. And Kennedy said, you're in the fix with me. And it's pretty tense because, LeMay in particular, he was an incredible hawk.
And much older World War II vet.
Right.
Well, of course, Kennedy was a World War II vet, but he was.
But he was a junior officer.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. They're taking orders from a lieutenant junior grade from the Navy, and they don't really appreciate it.
Well, Buzzkillers, we have a great story that's been coming out recently in various newspapers and various things around the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's the Vasily Arkhipov story, and it is based on this idea that one man, one Soviet submarine officer, saved the world. And we're going to look at that now because not only do we talk about whether Kennedy saved the world or Khrushchev saved the world or whatever – now we've gotten down to an almost anonymous naval officer in the Soviet Union. What's going on here, Professor?
Well, these, as I mentioned before, there are nuclear-armed submarines, Soviet nuclear-armed submarines and attack submarines in the vicinity of Cuba during the crisis. And the Americans are trying to – and this is, once again, this is the Navy acting on its own authority, as far as I know, the U.S. Navy is trying to force these submarines to the surface using practice depth charges, which in the middle of a nuclear crisis is, I would say, a pretty high-risk move.
I wonder how you can tell when you're in
right,
the summer.
Exactly,
how can you tell
right, exactly. Oh, relax. That's only practice. Yeah. Right. You have no idea.
It's made of rubber.
You're just being you're being forced to the surface by these loud explosions. In any case, there were Soviet officers on this one Soviet submarine, the B-59, which wanted to launch a nuclear torpedo against one of the U.S. surface ships in the region. And as far as we know, Vasily Arkhipov was a Soviet naval officer who overruled them and basically said, no, that would be a bad idea. And so they did not fire a nuclear torpedo.
Now, this is interesting because he's on the ship. He's on the submarine. He's on the B-59.
Right.
And apparently the rules, at least for that ship or those sets of missiles, and that ship, is that all three senior officers had to agree. And Arkhipov wasn't even the captain.
Right. Right, so he's like in effect violating the chain of command, but
But apparently they had this kind of, you know,
right
rule where they have to agree in order to
I think they had a similar rule on U.S. submarines as well, that you, for example, especially a nuclear armed sub, that you can't just launch on your own authority. You have to have sort of the top brass on board the submarine agree, you know, and it's partly as a safety measure. Yeah. But in this case, yeah, I mean, and this kind of thing happens, right? When you're on a sub and you think maybe your life is on the line and maybe World War III is about to break out, maybe you go ahead and take out a U.S. ship. Mm-hmm. And then here's the case, as far as we know, where actually cooler heads prevailed.
Well, it's interesting because the more I started to dig into this story, because I started to dig into this story because Edward Wilson wrote an article in The Guardian and had also written a novel about this kind of incident called The Midnight Swimmer. We'll put this up on the Buzzkill Bookshelf. But he wrote an article in The Guardian on the 50th anniversary of the crisis saying, quote, "If you were born before 27 October 1962, I apologize to all of our Russian buzzkillers for my pronunciations, Vasily Alexandrovich Arkhipov, one of the senior officers on the Soviet submarine, saved your life." Well, it looks like he did. He certainly at one point voted to veto the launch. But then it also, I did some more research and found out that actually the submarine commander sort of calmed down a bit and also may have changed his mind. And at the very least, he agreed to surface and get radio signals from Moscow, what's going on. And then, of course, once they did surface, they got radio signals from Moscow saying, you better beat it home because it's all over and we don't want to cause any more problems.
Right.
So although Vasily obviously made a very humanitarian and an important vote in that little meeting, it's not sure whether that was the actual the convincing argument or if the captain just said, oh, well, okay, let's just find out.
Right. But I think this points up a much broader, much more important point generally about the crisis. And this picks up what I said earlier. To me, the big question is, how close were we to World War III during this crisis? Mm-hmm. So that's an open debate on the latest evidence points in conflicting directions. On the one hand, you have two leaders, Kennedy and Khrushchev, who were more cautious than we ever thought, and that would argue for the likelihood of war being less than maybe we thought, right? Because the people in charge were cooler heads. And they were, for example, willing to sacrifice the interests of their allies, Turkey and Cuba, respectively, in order to prevent World War III. Mm-hmm. That's how I look at it. That's the good news. The bad news is the more we learn, the likelihood of war was greater because of the risk of accident. And this is one of many, many incidents during the crisis where, and here's the problem, during a crisis like this, both sides, they increase the alert level of their forces. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The other thing is, during a crisis, something the other side does is more likely to be interpreted as deliberate.
Even if it might be an accident.
For example, as it turns out, on the peak day of the crisis, October 27th, a U-2 spy plane veered into Soviet airspace.
Right.
We've known that for a long, long time. The problem with that is that in the crisis, the Soviets easily could have interpreted that as a reconnaissance flight that's the precursor to a first strike, because that's what you do.
Situation.
Right? That's what you do. You send a U-2 spy plane to check out Soviet defenses before you launch your strike. Now, is it happily, the Soviets didn't interpret that. They scrambled aircraft that went after the U-2, but that didn't break out into World War III, obviously, but it easily could have. And if we have time, I can do a couple of these because some of them are fascinating.
Well, no, please do. The buzzkillers hang on every word.
During the Cold War, our early warning radar to detect missiles was generally pointed north because Soviet missiles would come over the North Pole. Well, during the crisis, you have missiles now to your south. So they took one of these radar and they turned it 180 degrees to point toward Cuba.
Oh.
Right, to detect a Soviet missile launch from Cuba.
Yeah, sure.
Perfectly logical.
Yeah.
So far, so good. Problem is, during the crisis, someone accidentally popped a practice launch tape into the radar machine.
Eek. Ah.
And there was a really scary moment where, according to all their instruments at this radar station, it looked like the Soviets had launched a missile from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Now, happily, they were able to make some furious phone calls and find out that, oh, oops, someone just put the wrong tape in.
They were using, this was like digital tape, analog tape.
Yeah, analog tape. Exactly, analog tape. And this
popping
was,
in
yeah,
the cassette and made them, Steppenwolf and made on one side. And
dude, don't play the B-side. It's horrible.
The B-side is the launch sequence for the end of the world.
And that's the thing. And easily, had they not been able to make that phone call, Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, who knows? There was another case. One of my favorites is there was a U.S. military base up near the Canadian border mm-hmm. where...
Young Sarah Palin was going to be
looking for Russia through her binoculars. At the perimeter fence at the base, there was an alarm tripped off. And so a young sentry went out and saw a shadowy figure and opened fire on this alleged intruder.
Ooh.
And, you know, this set off a base alert, and they scrambled the nuclear-armed aircraft at this base and were about to send them aloft.
For one figure? A shadowy figure?
Because it seemed like maybe you have to assume in a case like that the base is under attack.
Wow.
Could it have been a wolf or a polar bear? Or what?
Have you heard this story?
No.
And it turned out that the intruder was a bear.
Oh.
The bear had zapped itself on the electric warning fence on the perimeter.
Oh, boy.
And, it was dark and snowy out, or not snowy, but it was bad weather, and the sentries thought it was maybe an intruder.
Oh.
What else happened? No one told the people who ran our nuclear testing program during the crisis to stop detonating nuclear weapons in the Pacific. So on October 25th, you'd think maybe they would think about that, but it didn't occur to them. So October 25th, this is back in the days where we tested nuclear weopons in the atmosphere.
Mm. Okay, now October 25th is important because that's right in the height of the crisis.
Right at the height of the crisis. You'd think that they would have sent out a memo, oh, by the way, stop detonating nuclear weapons over the Pacific because we're in the middle of this crisis.
People might get the wrong idea.
Exactly. You know how those Russians are. They might get the wrong idea. And there are lots of these little stories from out the crisis most historians would say the basic problem is both sides have these, by 1962, these massive, complex military institutions that are all over the world that include hundreds of thousands of personnel, mm-hmm. lots of high-tech equipment which can malfunction. And, you know, there's this model in political science where you've got the rational actor, right?
Right.
Where the president or the premier of the Soviet Union, they are completely in charge. They were not completely in charge, not even close. Look at the Arkhipov thing, right? In other words, you've got people who are acting on their own authority, isolated, acting according to standard operating procedures,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of going through the motions without understanding the larger implications. One of the things that in my field or in my study about the Jupiter missiles, there were Kennedy and his top people, they worried that that if we attack Cuba, the Soviets might attack the Jupiter missiles in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And the local commander of the Jupiter missiles, the Turks and the Americans on the ground, might not know when that attack is underway that it's not part of World War III, mm-hmm. but just a local attack. And he might then decide, you know what, I don't have orders to launch, but I have to launch because I have to assume that World War III is underway. And so the Kennedy administration actually sent an order down the chain of command, these missiles will not be launched except with express presidential order.
So even if you're fired on, you got to wait till I say so.
Right. So in other words, what you see in the middle of the crisis is Kennedy slowly getting his head around the idea that, wow, I don't really control this massive sort of complex
military.
I have to assume, I don't know this for a fact, I have to assume that that's one of the reasons why he's so cautious at the end of the crisis.
Because
he worries that this could just spin out of control.
Yeah.
And for example, if one of the things that Michael Dobbs revealed in his book mm-hmm. is that the Soviet forces in Cuba included tactical nuclear weapons. So if we launched a conventional invasion of Cuba.
Right. Troops on the ground.
Sort of a D-Day style amphibious invasion. Would have involved paratroopers and all that sort of thing. Huge conventional airstrikes. That the Soviet forces on the ground would have attacked our invasion force with tactical nuclear weapons.
Wow.
So our invasion force would have suffered enormous casualties, and that itself might have led to World War III, right? Because the American military might have said, look, they're using nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the Americans didn't even know those missiles were there in Cuba at the time. We assumed it was conventional forces and then the intermediate range, not the tactical stuff.
Tactical stuff is shorter range.
Maybe 50 miles, 90 miles, 100 miles.
That you could shoot at invading troops or shoot at tank formations.
Right.
Okay.
But it's all relative. A tactical weapon, it had a Hiroshima-sized warhead on it. It's only small compared to the big stuff at the time, but it's big by any reasonable standard.
Right.
I mean, we also had you know, Davy Crockett's and Honest John's and these sort of small, quote unquote small, where it's just like 2 kilotons. So we, maybe
wait a minute.
You know, as part of our arsenal. Yeah, and those,
names of the rockets were actually Davy Crockett and Honest John.
I am not making that up. You can check it out.
Lordy.
But yeah, okay. But they're basically...
What, did they leave this to Beaver to name them?
Well, they left it to the army. And part of this is about when nuclear weapons become the new sort of currency of military power,
everyone wants
to get in on the game.
Yeah.
So the Navy has their nuclear weapons, the Army has their nuclear weapons, and they're sort of battlefield nuclear weapons. And by the way, there were some early tests with artillery-launched nuclear weapons... And the early versions
coming
the,
out of the, tank barrels and
out of a big artillery piece,
okay.
Right? Okay. And in some of the early versions of this, the blast radius of the warhead was larger than the range of the artillery piece. So, in other words, the crew would only fire it once.
Wow.
Yeah. So they had to go back to the drawing board on that one.
Oh,
but so you have small means 2 kilotons, i.e., 2,000 tons of TNT equivalent.
Oh my goodness. So in a way, what we're looking at here is the standard story, which about the confrontation of the eyeball to eyeball thing, mm-hmm. and then everything calms down is a myth because it didn't happen. But it's also a myth because just because there hadn't been missiles fired on those ships or whatever, mm-hmm. or the big missiles hadn't been fired off because of those ships, mm-hmm. these little things could have happened
right.
all over the place.
Right.
So the whole eyeball to eyeball, back down, now we're okay thing is like a double myth.
Right. Yep.
Wow.
And by the way, it's true on both sides.
I get royalties on the word myth, folks. That's why I keep saying it over and over again.
It's like Dickens being paid by the word. Yeah,
which is also a myth, but never mind.
Sorry. Here I am perpetrating myths and I'm trying to clean them up.
But before we wrap it all up, just let me get this straight. We have a sort of... a tier of different people. We have very important people at the top, but we also have hundreds of thousands of
absolutely.
The other guys that could have
absolutely.
Made a decision at the wrong time that ended.
Right, and that's one of the reasons I highly recommend Michael Dobbs' book. It's called 1 Minute to Midnight. It came out in 2008. Mm-hmm. He not only dug through the documents, but also interviewed a lot of veterans. And he, in other words, the focus is, including in my book, the focus is always at the top. It's always about the White House, the Pentagon, the Kremlin. He does a great job of drilling down and finding out the people, like what was it like for the, by the way, another accident waiting to happen was we were running covert actions inside Cuba and blowing things up like sugar mills during the crisis. Oh. That was another thing that you would think you might want to put that on hiatus during the crisis, but it continued to go on.
Oh, so this has been a long time before.
This is part of the anti-Castro sort of CIA operations that are ongoing and ongoing during the crisis. Yeah. So the whole idea, and by the way, I don't want to sound too harsh about political scientists, but a lot of them write about so-called crisis management.
Yeah.
You can't look at the Cuban Missile Crisis and talk about crisis management. You talk about crisis survival.
Right. And crisis luck.
Yeah. Right. And crisis luck, absolutely. But in any case, Jobs is very good about making it clear that individual decisions by low-ranking people and people you never hear about, they are in some ways equally important because of the way this could have spun out of control.
It's like the difference between a chess game and a roll of the dice.
Yeah, pretty much.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And how horrifying do you think you're playing chess?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, actually, rolling the dice is really what's controlling here.
Well, except could this be said? Could it be said that at every point, even these kind of accidents and these Vasily Arkhipov situations, and in the White House and in the Kremlin, all the people who actually have to then make a decision, push a button or not to push the button, end up acting like grown-ups? Even the guys in the field and the commander.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess I think that would be the positive spin is that more often than not, when the chips are down, maybe you can rely on people to make the right decision. But
they had their big boy pants on. They didn't get all
right.
They didn't get
but
overreact or lose their temper. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. But one of my favorite quotes is from John Kenneth Galbraith, who after the missile crisis said, "Success in a lottery is no argument for lotteries."
That's right.
It's a great quote because it's, you know, and a lot of, I think now a lot of people would say the way you manage a crisis is to not get into it in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's partly on Kennedy as well as Khrushchev.
Well, Buzzkillers, this has been one of my favorite episodes. Of course, it's because we've had one of my favorite people here.
Aww.
Professor Nash, again, from Penn State, whose book's The Other Missiles of October. Whose book, The Other Missiles of October, is very, very important, very great read, and it's going to be on the Buzzkill bookshelf. So, Buzzkillers, I'd like to thank everyone, especially Aunt Ginger, who's out there monitoring things in the big wide world, Heather, who's just joined the team and I hope is going to be a long-standing member, and, of course, Professor Nash, the expert, the specialist, who's really, really brought the color and the vibrancy of this fascinating story, Crisis and Multiple Myths, to us. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.